From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Further instability in Yemen appears to have been forestalled for now. Conflict brews in Washington over an invitation to Israel's prime minister to address Congress. Russia strikes back at President Obama's State of the Union comments. We'll hear about a new strategy to fight tsunamis. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Yemen's embattled President Abid Rabu Mansour Hadi says he reached an agreement with Houthi rebels who have besieged his residence. In exchange for offering to scrap a proposed constitutional change, the rebels have agreed to withdraw from their seized positions and release a top official. The concessions came after 3 days of violence in the capital, Sana'a, and appeared to ease a standoff that raised alarms across the Gulf region to the United Nations and Washington, which relies on the current Yemeni government in its battle against Yemen-based al-Qaeda militants. The Houthi militants tightened their grip on the capital in the past 3 days, surrounding key government buildings. They are angry at the possibility of a new federal system for Yemen, which some feared would weaken their influence. The Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, John Boehner, is inviting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint meeting of Congress next month on the threat posed by Iran and radical Islam. Mr. Boehner, however, did not consult the White House first. VOA Cindy Sane reports from Capitol Hill.
Just hours after the glow and pageantry of President Barack Obama's State of the Union address to Congress, House Speaker John Boehner announced his invitation to the Israeli Prime Minister to address Congress on February the 11th.
I've invited the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to address a joint session of Congress on the grave threats of radical Islam and the threat that Iran poses to not only the Middle East, but frankly to the world.
Asked if he had consulted the White House before issuing the invitation, Boehner had this response.
I did not consult with the White House. The Congress can make this decision on its own. I don't believe I'm poking anyone in the eye. There is a serious threat that exists in the world. And the president last night kind of papered over it.
Analysts say invitations to foreign leaders to address Congress are traditionally issued only after close consultation with the White House and the State Department. White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters Wednesday the White House is reserving judgment until they speak with Israeli officials. A State Department official also indicated this invitation is a departure from regular protocol. The Israeli Prime Minister has addressed Congress twice, in 1996 and 2011. The visit would come just weeks before Israeli elections in March and could give him a boost. Cindy Sane, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
Israeli police say a Palestinian man stabbed at least 11 people on and near a bus in Tel Aviv, leaving several critically wounded. The attack Wednesday began with a man stabbing the bus driver and several passengers. Police say he stabbed another person on the street while trying to flee. The 23-year-old suspect was shot in the leg and then captured. Police identified the man as a resident of the Israeli-occupied West Bank who entered Israel illegally. After Israel allegedly killed senior-level Hezbollah and Iranian officials in an attack in Syria earlier this week, analysts say it is not just regional tensions on the rise. The incident also highlights Iran's role in the Syrian war and other conflicts. Heather Murdoch has details.
After announcing an attack in Syria that killed 11 people, including leaders from Hezbollah and Iran's Revolutionary Guard, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah says his men are prepared to fight Israel any place, any time. A senior lecturer in the study of Islam and the Muslim world at King's College in London, Carol Kirsten, says retaliation is expected.
They have to do something. I mean, they're one of the most powerful political actors in Lebanon, so they cannot just stand by and do nothing.
Other analysts say the response from Hezbollah or Iran might be in the form of psychological warfare, raising fears without striking. Israel is bracing for possible attack, closing roads and deploying soldiers to border areas. But Chatham House Associate Fellow Nadim Shahadi says this is old news. Shahadi says more significant than raising tension is what the attack reveals about Hezbollah's alliance with Iran's Revolutionary Guard, also known as IRGC.
The relationship between Hezbollah and the IRGC is a well-established one, but this sort of flagrantly puts it to the forefront. They were there as part of the same team under Iranian command.
He adds this relationship also exists in Yemen, Bahrain, and Iraq, strengthening militant groups allied with Iran, the chief rival of U.S. ally and oil giant Saudi Arabia. Shahadi says Western allies in the Middle East are uneasy because the United States appears to be more accommodating to Iran before upcoming proposed nuclear talks.
American policy of engagement with Iran ignores that there is a silent war that Iran is waging through the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, in the whole region.
He explains that the U.S.-led fight against the Islamic State is increasingly viewed as offering tacit support to Syria's Assad regime, which is allied with Hezbollah and Iran. He says the U.S. failure to communicate with its allies about its evolving relationship with Iran is causing anxiety. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, London.
Kurdish fighters launch what they call a new large-scale offensive against Islamic State in northern Iraq. Security officials say they are carrying out the operation near the Mosul Dam. They are being backed by three U.S.-led coalition airstrikes near Mosul and three more airstrikes near Tal Afar. A number of IS-held buildings and heavy weapons were destroyed. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is accusing pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine of violating an earlier truce deal with a blatant land grab in new fighting near the Russian border. Secretary Kerry spoke Wednesday in Washington, calling the new fighting an alarming situation, adding that rebels have violated a deal they signed in September by extending their control of disputed territory more than 1,000 square kilometers. Earlier Wednesday, Ukraine linked the new fighting, much of it near the rebel-controlled city of Donetsk and Luhansk, to the recent deployment of more than 9,000 regular Russian troops into Ukraine territory. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov rejected Kiev's accusations. At his annual press briefing, Mr. Lavrov said Moscow is willing to help facilitate a new ceasefire to stop the fighting in eastern Ukraine, which has killed almost 5,000 people. Mr. Lavrov also lashed out at President Obama's criticism of the Kremlin's actions in Ukraine. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov said Wednesday that President Obama's comments showed the U.S. has adopted a policy of confrontation and failed to assess its own actions. During his State of the Union address Tuesday, Mr. Obama said U.S. support for Ukraine was a principled stand against Russia's bullying of a smaller state. The U.S. president also noted its allies were united against Russia's aggression, while Moscow faced diplomatic isolation and a tattered economy. Mr. Lavrov said the U.S. had pressured allies, such as Europe and Japan, to gang up on Russia. He says Tuesday's speech by President Obama shows that at the center of their philosophy is only one thing. We are number one, and everyone else has to respect that. He says this is a little outdated and does not reflect today's reality. It demonstrates, he says, that the U.S. wants to dominate the world and cannot merely be first among equals. Russia's foreign minister said Western attempts to isolate it would fail. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
The Nigerian militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for mass killings in the city of Baga and is promising further attacks. A video posted online shows the purported Islamist group's leader, Abu Bakr Shekau, declaring, "We carried out the Baga massacre and we are going to do more." Fighters are seen showing off what appear to be thousands of rifles along with grenades, rocket launchers, machine guns, and stacked boxes of ammunition. Estimates of the death toll in Baga range from 150 to 2,000. Shekau warns that more deaths are coming and also issues threats against the presidents of Cameroon and Chad. A top Lord's Resistance Army commander is now in custody at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Dominic Ongwen will undergo medical exams after being flown from the Central African Republic. His arrival at the court ends an almost 10-year effort to have him face 3 counts of crimes against humanity and another 4 counts of war crimes. The Lord's Resistance Army is accused of killing and kidnapping tens of thousands of people across Uganda and 3 nearby countries over the past 30 years.
Hi, this is Larry London. Join me for Border Crossings every weekday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix. Border Crossings is where you decide what we play. It's an hour of your requests, great giveaways, and interviews with music superstars. Tune in to Border Crossings Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA Music Mix.
2 weeks after the Paris terrorist attacks, the French government announced new anti-terrorism measures and a boost in spending to pay for them. Lisa Bryant has details.
The new measures range from hiring nearly 2,700 more security personnel to recruiting more imams for French prisons and offering information on the internet aimed at preventing youth from becoming radicalized. Speaking Wednesday on television, Prime Minister Manuel Valls said the government will spend an additional $490 million during the next 3 years to pay for them.
La protection des agents sur la voie publique est une priorité. Il s'agit de les doter des gilets pare-balles.
Mr. Valls said protection of police and other security officers will be upgraded to account for the presence of war weapons on the streets. 3 police officers were killed during the terrorist attacks earlier this month.
De même, les unités en charge de la lutte contre le cyber-jihadisme bénéficieront d'équipements plus performants.
In addition, the Prime Minister said authorities will reinforce the fight against cyber jihadism and step up surveillance of terrorist suspects. He said surveillance is needed right now for about 3,000 suspects in France and abroad. Officials also estimate about 1,200 French nationals have joined jihadist groups in the Middle East. Meanwhile, President François Hollande said the government will keep thousands of defense jobs it had originally planned to cut. The new French measures have earned a mixed reaction.
Moi, ce que j'allais dire, c'est que de temps perdu. Depuis 3 ans, nous avons...
Spokesman for the center-right opposition UMP party, Sébastien Huyghe, faulted the leftist government for reacting to militant Islam too slowly. Far-right National Front leader Marine Le Pen called the government's measures insufficient. She said they failed to address the root causes of Islamist terrorism, including immigration. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The attacks on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo have inspired mass demonstrations in support of free speech around the world, as well as smaller rallies condemning the cartoons that some Muslims find blasphemous. In China, where the officially atheist government imposes heavy restrictions on speech, the demonstrations have led to a different reaction, as we hear from Shannon Van Zandt.
Charlie Hebdo has now printed more than 7 million copies of its first edition since gunmen killed 8 members of the editorial staff. The massive print run reflects the outpouring of support from many who see buying a copy as a rejection of the deadly plot to silence the magazine. But among some Muslims, there is renewed outrage over the magazine's cover that again features a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, which some consider to be blasphemous. This simmering divide over free speech has also reached China, where the government keeps tight control over all publications and the internet. For Chinese authorities, the Paris attacks proved the dangers of an unrestrained press. The Xinhua News Agency published an editorial concluding there should be limits to free speech. Quote, "If people would put limits on themselves when venting freedom and respect others," Xinhua continued, "there would be fewer tragedies in the world." While it is expected that China's state-controlled media would not champion the inherent value of free speech, William Ni, a China researcher at Amnesty International, says the response also echoes Beijing's views on national sovereignty.
As they put it, the world is diversified and every religion and culture has its own core values. So I think that what they want to do is solidify this idea that different countries and different civilizations have their own core values that other countries need to respect.
China has long rejected foreign criticism of its tight restrictions of political freedoms, saying that other countries have no business dictating how it governs its citizens. Ni says the Charlie Hebdo incident has highlighted how China also believes that other nations have the right to restrict speech as they see fit. He says Beijing draws parallels between its rejection of foreign criticism and the angry response from Muslims who see the Charlie Hebdo cartoons as deeply offensive.
So, of course, in this context, it would be that maybe the Western press needs to respect the fact that many people find it offensive to depict the Prophet Muhammad. But at the same time, they need to respect the CCP's own core values and all the things that potentially entail.
An editorial titled Free Speech Mania May Intensify Clashes in the state-backed Global Times newspaper similarly criticized the West for its commitment to free speech. What's advised now, says the editorial, quote, is that French society needs to restrain itself from portraying the prophet and prevent a pursuit of free expression from turning into a religion. The editorial warned of more violence and conflict in Europe, fueled by unrestrained freedoms of speech and the press. Xiaohe Chang, a professor of international relations at Renmin University, says Chinese views on freedom of speech are heavily influenced by the Chinese political and educational systems that do not emphasize the history of civil society in other countries. Chang says that is why reaction to the Paris attacks is so different in China from the rest of the world.
Chinese people also need to understand the political cultures in Paris that peoples in that countries enjoy a high degree of freedom, including the freedom of expressions.
Gauging reaction among Chinese citizens is difficult given government censorship, but some commentators online express support for free speech in the wake of attacks. Others question why they cannot march in solidarity like the millions of people in Paris last week, since Beijing banned such gatherings. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is PCUSA@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Pakistan says it wants an early repatriation of Afghan refugees in the country, but does not intend to forcibly evict them. Afghan officials warn that unwarranted pressure on the refugee population as part of Islamabad's increased counterterrorism measures could actually hinder bilateral ties. Ayaz Ghul has details.
Pakistan hosts nearly 3 million Afghan refugees that have fled decades of conflict in neighboring Afghanistan. While the refugee population has long been seen as a burden on the struggling national economy in the wake of dwindling foreign financial resources, they are increasingly being linked to the rise in criminal and extremist activities in Pakistan. A deadly militant attack on a school in Peshawar last month that killed 134 children and 16 staff members has prompted Pakistani authorities to intensify counter-terrorism measures. They include, among other steps, registration of Afghans living as illegal migrants and those who have been registered as refugees in cities being pushed to move back to their identified refugee camps. Speaking in Islamabad Wednesday, Pakistani advisor on national security and foreign policy Sartaj Aziz explained the situation.
We have 1.7 million registered refugees and another 1.3, 1.4 unregistered refugees. Now, obviously, if they have to go by the end of 2015, then they can't go all in December 2015. The process has to start. We are in touch with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to facilitate those refugees who want to go back voluntarily to areas that are peaceful and can absorb them.
A trilateral agreement involving Pakistan, Afghanistan and the UN Agency for Refugees, the UNHCR, gives Afghan refugees until the end of this year to go back to their country. But continuing conflict and security concerns, coupled with a lack of economic opportunities in Afghanistan, have slowed down the repatriation process. Pakistani advisor Aziz says that relations with Afghanistan have seen significant improvement in recent months, and the two sides are working closely to address the refugee issue. He says that under a UN voluntary repatriation program, a large number of Afghans have gone back to their country, but more needs to be done to speed up the process. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
There are beach towns on coastlines around the world where tsunamis could cause terrible devastation. The property damage is unavoidable, and some governments are spending millions on early warning systems that could give residents more time to seek safety on higher ground. One low-lying coastal town in the northwest U.S. state of Washington is copying a strategy used in Japan to survive tsunamis. Tom Bonsi explains.
Around this time next year, Okasta Elementary School will have a new gym with a reinforced roof that can double as a tsunami refuge. This will be the first structure in North America purposely designed for tsunami vertical evacuation. Students say the rare catastrophe weighs on their minds, living as they do at the edge of the ocean.
When I think of a tsunami, it kind of scares me. I just think about it all the time.
Their hometown of Westport, Washington, is basically one long sandspit. The elementary and high schools were built on one of the highest dune ridges around, but that's only about 8 meters above sea level, and that may not be high enough in the worst-case scenario. A magnitude 9.0 full rip of the offshore Cascadia fault line. Models predict the subsequent tsunami will wash over pretty much everything for miles around. Structural engineer Cale Ash took that as a design challenge.
The extra features would include the pile foundations, which were made a little bit larger in diameter and also deeper to make sure they could resist any scour, any washing away of the site that would happen from the tsunami flow. The building's also designed to resist impact. As the water comes in, it can bring debris like logs and vehicles and other stuff.
Four outside stairways lead to a flat concrete and steel reinforced roof capable of holding more than 1,000 people. Ash says the rooftop refuge is about 4 meters above the maximum estimated tsunami height. School bond voters along the outer Washington coast agreed to tax themselves for the extra $1 million to $1.5 million cost of the tsunami safety enhancements. Okasta School District Superintendent Paula Ackerland says they did that even though the area struggles with poverty and high unemployment.
Our community made the safety of children for this generation and generations to come its highest priority.
Fortunately, along most of the Washington, Oregon, and California coast, natural high ground is not as far away as it is in Westport.
Vertical evacuation, to me, it is never the preferable option.
Geologist Lori Dengler is an earthquake and tsunami expert at Humboldt State University in California.
And if you talk to any emergency manager, they are not going to want to have people isolated in the top of a building, possibly for days or maybe even a week or longer.
That said, Dengler understands sometimes the last choice is the only choice. In places like Westport and Ocean Shores, Washington, and Seaside, Oregon, she says vertical evacuation could offer the only chance of survival and should be looked at. But she stresses a key issue whenever such an evacuation structure is built is it tall enough? After the devastating 2011 tsunami in Japan, the geology professor participated in a survey of the disaster zone that examined the performance of vertical evacuation. The Japanese coast is the only place in the world where designated vertical evacuation structures are common. The reconnaissance team heard how this saved many lives, but also noted that more than 100 elevated safe havens were overtopped by the tsunami surges on March 11, 2011. Dengler points out that if a tsunami turns out to be a little bigger than expected, people who evacuate inland to high ground can continue to go up or further inland.
But once you're on the third or the fourth floor of a four-story building, you can't go any higher.
For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Westport, Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On January 22, 1440, Ivan Vasilievich, known as Ivan the Great, was born. He became the Grand Prince of Moscow in 1462 following the death of his father. Ivan is credited with greatly expanding the kingdom's territory and setting the groundwork for the Russian state. On this day in 1561, English philosopher and statesman Francis Bacon was born. A member of the House of Commons and an advisor to British royalty, Sir Francis advocated the use of inductive reasoning and the advancement of the scientific method. Bacon believed that all scientific theories should be tested by observations made in the natural world and not by intuition or revelation. In 1666, Shah Jahan, the ruler of the Mughal Empire in India, died. During his 30-year reign, he oversaw the construction of the Taj Mahal, built as a tomb for his wife. English poet George Gordon Byron, better known as Lord Byron, was born on this day in 1788. Don Juan, a satire on contemporary English society, is considered among his greatest works. In 1879, the two-day Battle of Rorke's Drift in southern Africa took place at the beginning of the Anglo-Zulu War. A tiny British contingent turned back repeated attacks by native Zulu warriors. That same day, a 1,400-man British force was virtually wiped out by Zulus in the Battle of Isandlwana. The defeat led the British thereafter to conduct the war in a more aggressive way, leading to their victory and the end of the Zulu nation. Britain's Queen Victoria died on this day in 1901. Victoria reigned for more than 63 years at the height of British industrial and imperial power. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is committed to supporting efforts by the governments and people of the Arab Peninsula to end the threat posed by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP. As part of that support, we are offering rewards totaling up to $45 million, leading to the locations of the terrorist group's 8 key leaders. AQAP was formed in 2009 by Yemeni and Saudi terrorists under the leadership of Nasir al-Wahishi, who headed a predecessor Al-Qaeda group in Yemen. It has conducted many high-profile terrorist attacks against the Yemeni government, U.S., and other foreign interests. In March 2009, an AQAP suicide bomber killed 4 South Korean tourists and their Yemeni guide. A few months later, AQAP dispatched a suicide bomber who attempted to detonate an explosive device aboard a Northwest Airlines flight over the continental U.S. Other attacks followed. Rewards are offered for Nasir al-Wahishi, AQAP's top leader, responsible for approving AQAP targets, recruiting new members, allocating resources, and directing attacks. In 2013, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri named him as his deputy. Also, Qasim al-Rimi, a senior AQAP military commander who has played an important role in recruiting AQAP operatives. Ibrahim Hassan Tali al-Hasiri is AQAP's primary bomb maker. He gained notoriety for recruiting his younger brother for a failed suicide bomb attack against Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Nayef in August 2009. Shaki Ali Ahmed al-Badani is an AQAP leader and operative. He played a key role planning a major attack that led the United States to close more than 20 diplomatic posts in the Middle East and Africa in the summer of 2013. Jalal Balaidi is an AQAP regional emir involved in 2013 with planning bomb attacks on various Western diplomatic facilities and personnel. Others being sought are Ibrahim Rubayash, a senior AQAP Sharia official and advisor who provides the justification for the group's attacks, Ibrahim Albana, the group's chief of security, and Othman al-Ghamdi, who has helped raise funds and stockpile weapons. The U.S. guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. The tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.